In this part of Focus 580, we'll be inviting your healthcare questions. This is the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do every once in a while with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, grown-ups, children, and sees people with a wide variety of medical concerns. And the idea of this program is that it's general and open to whatever's on your mind. We do have certain shows that we do with specialists occasionally, but we thought it'd be good to have an opportunity for you to ask general kinds of questions of a family doctor, and that's what we do here on this show. If you'd like to call in, talk with Dr. Jeff, all you have to do is call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That's good for anyone. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for it. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
We have someone ready to go, so we'll just start right in with them in Urbana, and line one.
Good morning. I would like to know about the, spastic colon and an irritated bowel syndrome. And could you tell me for both of those, what is the cause and what can be done and what is the treatment? Oh, I'm sorry. What is the cause, what the symptoms are, and what the treatment would be?
Well, you picked a great question here. The terms that you use, spastic colon, irritable bowel syndrome, are pretty much synonymous. People have also used the term colitis, though technically that's not quite accurate because that refers to other types of illnesses, but many people actually use that term, so you need to be careful about it. But irritable bowel syndrome is the most commonly accepted term for a condition the cause of which is really yet unknown. So I can't tell you a definitive cause. The symptoms are fairly characteristic, though there are wide variations in how individuals present. But fairly frequently, people will complain of alternating bouts of either constipation and then diarrhea. They will complain of cramping, bloating, and fairly significant abdominal discomfort, but there aren't any other signs of actual ill health. People don't lose weight, their appetite remains good, they don't have any blood in their stools, and their symptoms are present in many instances for months and years on end without any apparent change in their overall health. This is often thought to run in families, and it's thought that there may indeed be a genetic predisposition toward it. It seems to be more common in women than in men. It can present early in life. We have seen children and adolescents with this particular problem. And the usual treatment involves trying to typically regulate your diet well enough to make it simply easier for your colon to function more comfortably.
And what is involved in that, please?
All the fiber and all the fluids you can possibly get.
Fiber and fluids.
Now, in most instances, whole wheat, the whole grains, fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, those are the dietary sources of fiber. If you're able to get an adequate amount of fiber in this way, that's great. Some individuals simply don't have the opportunity to do that as well as they'd like. Using a fiber supplement, of which there are dozens of different brands, all of which are fairly similar, I typically tell people simply pick something that you know tastes good to you, that you tolerate well, and make sure that you take it with enough water.
Is there a difference between organic and inorganic fiber supplements?
Most of the fiber supplements out there are ultimately derived from some type of organic product. Psyllium is the most common non-digestible form of fiber. And if you look on the label, most of them contain some form of this.
Okay. Would rectal incontinence be part of this syndrome?
No. If there is actual difficulty controlling the bowel movement, then that needs to be formally evaluated, because that is not a symptom of irritable bowel.
Ah. And what specialist or what kind of doctor who works with this would I get in touch with?
Normally, you would simply start with your family physician. If there was evidence of an anatomical abnormality present in the rectal or anal area, occasionally this is something that can be addressed through the operative services of the colon and rectal surgery department. There are specially trained surgeons who work just in the colon and rectal area.
So would it require surgery?
Depends on the nature of the problem. Some of these are neurological abnormalities that are not amenable to surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Certain conditions present could indeed be potentially helped by surgery.
Okay, colon and rectal surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the circumstances where for a neurological problem, there's nothing else to be done, I assume?
Certain medications may be able to be helpful here, but it's unlikely that this would be something seen all by itself as a primary neurological problem. Most neurological problems that would affect the control of the rectal sphincter would probably also involve disruption in bladder control and may be associated with symptoms of weakness in the lower extremities as well.
And is there anything that can be done for rectal incontinence?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Dr. Bala Kumara is one of our colon and rectal surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
She specializes in this particular area, and there are a number of treatments that include surgery and some non-operative therapies as well. Because the rectal sphincter is a muscle, it is amenable to being strengthened and trained.
Okay, and what is the lady's name, please?
Bala Kumara.
How do you spell her last name?
I'm probably going to murder it here.
Okay.
But it starts Balakamura, I believe.
Balakamura.
There's a K in there somewhere.
Okay.
Bala Kumara.
Okay, and so if there is improper neurological flow in the lower extremities, that would be denoted by not walking very easily.
Correct.
Okay, and that could also be a neurological problem with the sphincter muscle. Is there training for the sphincter muscle the way there is for the bladder muscle?
Yes, there is.
There is.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular doctor would know about it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you have been really helpful, and I thank you so much for doing this, and really appreciate being able to talk to you.
Well, you're very welcome.
Thanks for the call. And certainly other folks can call in if you have questions, things you'd like to discuss with our guest, Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician from Carle Clinic on a fairly regular basis. He stops by here. We do this show, and it's wide open. Whatever it is you'd like to discuss, I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
David, I'd just like to follow up a little bit on that last questioner's comments. I want to point out that irritable bowel syndrome is a benign process. It's relatively common, and even though it's uncomfortable, it does not indicate any type of colon cancer. It doesn't put people at higher risk for necessarily other colon problems, and it is really quite amenable to attention to fiber and fluids in the diet. Occasionally, medications used as antispasmodics will help relieve some of the discomfort. Those are usually only necessary on a temporary or sometimes intermittent basis. The vast majority of folks will indeed improve significantly with simply getting more fiber and fluids into their diet. Part of the difficulty here is that a lot of processed foods are relatively low in fiber, leaving little residue in the colon. That makes it actually physically harder for the colon to empty. And what I often explain to patients is I ask them to think about whether it's easier to get toothpaste out of a full tube or an empty tube. And they kind of grasp the concept of the muscles of the colon have to squeeze very, very hard if you have that sort of empty tube of toothpaste. That causes some cramping and some spasm, which is uncomfortable. The muscle eventually tires and then completely relaxes and then doesn't want to move well at all. And then constipation seems to follow the initial about where the increased muscular activity was actually causing diarrhea. And that's why you tend to get these alternating phases of diarrhea and then constipation. Basically, with a full tube of toothpaste, you don't have to squeeze too hard to move the toothpaste through. And this is actually makes it easier for the colon muscles to move the contents through the colon without having to expend as much energy. They don't tire as often. They tend to function better that way.
Mm-hmm. And it also happens that's the same, what you'll be doing at the same time, I guess, is to doing one good thing for yourself that should also help to reduce your cancer risk, because we're always saying that, you know, to maintain the bowel health, what mm-hmm. you want to do is make sure you got a lot of fiber in your diet.
There have been a fair number of studies that have at least suggested that a diet high in fiber is conducive toward lowering one's overall risk for cancer. It's recently been debated whether that specifically includes a lower risk for colon cancer, but it's one of those things that probably falls into the category of it can't hurt you to eat a high-fiber diet.
All right. Something else actually came up on a recent show was last week when our OBGYN was on the program, and a caller called in and related the story, said that she had just recently had her first screening colonoscopy. And I think her reason for calling in was basically to say, it's whatever you may have heard, what you may think about it, yeah, it doesn't sound like it's all that pleasant, but the fact is it's not that bad. Not such a big deal. And then we had, I had with Dr. Troopin a little bit of discussion about, well, what exactly are the recommendations about when you should, when and who should have this test? And she said, well, there may be some difference of opinion among doctors about exactly what, how this should proceed. Is there some sort of consensus that says what sort of screening we're going to do and how invasive it's going to be and who's going to get it and when is the first time that we're going to do that?
I think a good place to start would probably be with the general recommendations of the American Cancer Society, which currently recommend that men and women beginning at age 50 start to have some type of regular evaluation for their risk for colon cancer. Assuming a low-risk patient, i.e. somebody who does not have a strong family history of colon cancer already. The current recommendations include an annual check for blood in the stool, which is a little kit that patients take home and collect a stool specimen and then simply mail it in a special envelope back to the laboratory, plus some visualization of the colon. The current recommendations include flexible sigmoidoscopy, which is a direct visualization with a flexible fiber optic scope of the lower third of the colon. On a statistical basis, that's where most colon cancers have been in the past. There is some evidence that because we're finding those now on a statistical basis, more of them are being found farther beyond where the flexible sigmoidoscope can actually see. The advantage of the hemocult cards and flexible sigmoidoscopy is it's something that the hemocult cards can be done at home, It's not invasive. It's very simple and inexpensive. The downside is there are a lot of things that could potentially put blood in your stool, so it's not specific for colon cancer, though the early stages of colon cancers are known to have a propensity to bleed. But other things can also put blood in your stool. Flexible sigmoidoscopy has the advantage of being an office-based procedure that only takes 10 or 15 minutes. It does not require sedation or anesthesia. It has the limitations of the fact that it will cause some crampy discomfort during the exam, which isn't necessarily pleasant. It's kind of like having a bad gas cramp. And it has the limitation of not visualizing the entire colon. Consequently, some other organizations have said, well, in a situation where you want to check out the rest of the colon, you could do an air contrast barium enema or colon X-ray. The downside there is that small lesions can be missed on an X-ray, and if there is something, you still got to go in there and get it. So you may end up having an endoscopy procedure afterwards anyway. Colonoscopy offers the advantage of being able to look at the entire colon. If there is something present, it can be biopsied at the same time. So it allows not only diagnosis but treatment, because you can remove small polyps. And the polyps are small growths that have some potential to become malignancies. The disadvantage of colonoscopy is that it does require sedation. You will not be able to drive yourself home afterwards. Somebody will have to come with you. You won't be allowed to make any major decisions for the rest of the day because of the effects of the medication. And the preparation, emptying your colon before the exam, is much more extensive with colonoscopy than it is with sigmoidoscopy. And in fact, more people hate the prep than they do the exam, because at least during that portion of the exam for colonoscopy, you're out. You don't know what's going on. But the prep, you had to sort of endure the night before. The prep there is typically close to a gallon of a slightly salty solution that basically, as you drink it, everything goes on through along with it. And so you spend the greater part of an evening very, very close to the throne room. The colonoscopy is assumed to be able to be as effective as flexible sigmoidoscopy and testing for occult blood. That has been shown to be effective in reducing the morbidity from colon cancer. It's simply assumed that, by extension, that colonoscopy will have that same advantage, though that really hasn't been officially tested yet. There haven't been studies comparing the two different methods. But I think it's probably reasonable to assume that colonoscopy would be just as effective as sigmoidoscopy and hemocult testing. So any of those three or some combination of those would probably be considered reasonable for routine screening. Sigmoidoscopy is done about every 5 years. Colonoscopy only needs to be done about every 10 years. The best method is yet to be determined, because they haven't tried these different methods head-to-head to compare different populations as to which did a better job. But I think any one of those is probably reasonable, and I do think it's important for people to periodically get tested in some fashion. Colon cancer is one of those cancers where if you find it early, it is indeed treatable and curable. And the problem is that the early stages of it don't have a lot of symptoms. If you wait until you have significant colon symptoms, in many instances, you've waited too long. And that's been the biggest drawback to encouraging otherwise well, healthy people to go through a procedure. They say, well, I don't feel bad. And our response is, well, we don't want to wait until you feel bad, because then it's going to be a little late. But you do have to screen quite a few people in order to find those people who have either early malignancies or even sometimes more advanced malignancies.
We're already about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic. If you have questions about this or anything else, that's what this program is about. We just call it Talk to the Family Doctor. Whatever concerns you may have, you call in and discuss them with Dr. Swearingen. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Want to add some?
Yeah, Dave, yeah. We talked about the average risk patient, and I want to just make a comment about the higher risk patient.
Okay.
Somebody who already has a family history, you know, mom or dad or brother and sister had colon cancer, they are pretty much by definition at higher risk, and they should routinely have complete colonoscopy done probably at an age about 10 years before it occurred in the family member. So, you know, if dad had colon cancer at 50, you don't want to wait until you're 50 to start your screening. You want to start at about 40.
Okay.
Okay.
Here's a couple of callers here. We'll go to someone in Urbana on line one right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm the lady who called earlier. Could you tell me if a sigmoidoscopy is required before one would see a colorectal surgeon to look at bowel incontinence?
No, not necessarily, though it will probably be part of the examination done by the colorectal surgeon. That's a procedure that they routinely do in their office as part of their evaluation.
And what is involved in a sigmoidoscopy?
The preparation. The preparation is usually done in the office there just prior to the procedure itself. It simply requires a couple of cleansing enemas to empty out the lower part of the bowel.
Oh, okay. And that can be done in the office?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go on here to line number two. This is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Is there one best high blood pressure medicine for a systolic high blood pressure? My diastolic is fine, but the systolic is too high.
There is a general recommendation that for systolic hypertension that physicians start with the diuretic mm-hmm. class of medications.
Mm-hmm. I do take that.
And that's probably the first step mm-hmm. That would be recommended. Everything thereafter simply depends on how well does that work for you and how well do you tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
But as a sort of a gross generalization, the initial treatment for systolic hypertension would be with a diuretic type medication, and then simply depending on how your blood pressure is doing, you may add other agents to
what
that.
What would be the second one?
Well, that's going to depend a lot on what your other medical conditions are.
Mm-hmm.
There are advantages and disadvantages to a number of the different blood pressure medications. Let's say, for example, if you're also diabetic, the addition of what's called an ACE inhibitor would be a very reasonable choice because that helps protect your kidney against some of the damage from diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an asthmatic, you wouldn't want to use a beta blocker, another class of medication, because that could potentially make your asthma worse. So a lot simply depends on what other medical conditions you do or don't have as to which other medications you would add mm-hmm. to the diuretic.
Yeah, I do have some asthma, so...
So the beta blocker class of drugs would not be ideal for you.
Yeah, I've been taking a small amount of beta blockers, so maybe I should be on something else.
Well, calcium channel blockers are another choice that would be reasonable uh-huh. in the setting of asthma, or the ACE inhibitors as well would be reasonable.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Let's go next to Peoria, line four. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. A lot of people are constipated in this country, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, in World War I, they gave all the soldiers prunes. You put them in a jar and pour hot water on them. In about 3 days, they're ready to take. You take three or four of those prunes, and they'll make you go.
An excellent dietary suggestion.
Mm-hmm. You know what they called them in World War I?
No, sir.
Army strawberries. No kidding. My dad was in World War I.
Army strawberries. Well, I will have to add that to my fund of knowledge.
You try them. It works.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks. That's still on a lot of people's list. I know prunes or prune juice is still mm-hmm. A favorite thing, but I think probably there are other fruits that have will do the same thing for you. That if you
That's correct.
You could, you don't just have to eat prunes. If you had what are the recommended servings of fruit
in
per
general.
Day in general,
yes.
that should help.
That's correct.
All right, very good. Southeastern Illinois next, line number one. Hello.
Yes, the old saying, if at first you don't succeed, eat fruit.
Yeah. That would work.
I wondered, Doctor, if you'd come across in your literature anything on the thermal catheter treatment for BPH, since I talked to you about it before.
I have only read a little bit more about that. I am not yet aware of whether that's available locally or not.
The experimental stage, you think?
I believe it's still being trialed. Yeah, and I would anticipate probably within the next year or so that if it met success in the early trials, that it will become a more widespread therapy. In terms of the specifics of who might be doing that, I would probably have to defer to the urology department to answer that specifically, but I think it does hold some promise as a technique separate from open surgery.
Certainly sounds like a simple procedure. I mean, in the doctor's office and so forth, it would be, you know, at least the first means of a simple means of treatment.
Right. The only potential disadvantage here is that with simple destruction of the tissue that way, you don't necessarily have a diagnosis of entirely benign tissue, but I suppose that could be alleviated by simply doing a random prostate biopsy before the procedure was carried out. It's not uncommon during routine prostate surgery for them to discover little pockets of prostate cancer that may indeed change the way the follow-up should be undertaken.
Yeah. This is a question. I don't know whether this will be in your range or not, but what happens in the body? How does the body know it's tired? What happens in the – and I'm talking about real physical fatigue, not mental fatigue that goes with depression or something like that. What happens physiologically in the body that signals to the body that it's tired?
Well, if you're talking about muscular tiredness as a result of physical exertion.
No, just general fatigue.
Well,
what signals that to the body? I mean, what makes the body or the person say, you know, I'm just generally pooped?
Well, it would depend on the origin of the fatigue. Fatigue as a symptom can be associated with a whole host of medical illnesses. So if you're fatigued because you have an illness, it'll obviously depend on what the cause of the illness was. For example, if you're simply anemic, you may indeed be fatigued because your body is having difficulty carrying enough oxygen in the bloodstream because your blood count is low. Mm. On the other hand, if you're fatigued because your thyroid is underactive, it's because your metabolism has slowed because of lack of thyroid hormone. So fatigue isn't caused by one central reason.
I was really thinking, though, not of a disease origin fatigue, but of just simply, you know, haven't you ever had the feeling that you're just completely worn out and it's not that you're anemic or that you have it's an individual occurrence. I mean, it's not a continuing state.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, if it's related to physical activity, it's simply the breakdown products of metabolism from the muscles that get into your bloodstream that your body then reacts to, and that's what makes you feel tired and sore from physical exercise.
Okay, then it is the metabolic waste in the bloodstream that sort of signals that to the body?
Yes.
Yeah. I have another question here that I'll throw out for any discussion that you might want to, whether I don't know whether you want to talk about it or not, but the program before, this program was the Hemlock Society and people ending life. The situation of a doctor who is a fighter and who considers death his opponent, and the situation of doctors who will fight to keep a patient alive, even bring them back from death after they really have more or less died, and bring them back even, and oftentimes the patient will be quite angry that this has occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that you might want to say about the doctor's viewpoint on the fight, the fight against death and so forth. I don't know whether you want to comment on that or not, but I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to comment. I don't believe that there's one single physician viewpoint on this particular subject. It's much more an individual response. But I think the caller raises a good point in that if a patient has specific wishes of what they do or don't want done in particular situations, I think it's very, very appropriate to make your physician aware of that. Now, if the physician says, I'm not comfortable with that because I want to do X or Y, then I think that patient needs to get a different physician, because I do think ultimately it's the patient's right to decide how they wish to be cared for, especially in situations that might potentially be terminal. The whole debate over whether sort of legally assisted suicide should be made more available remains a huge sort of philosophical moral debate, and I'm not sure that's the intent of this particular program. There is, I believe, in Oregon, a law that makes it easier for physicians to help terminally ill patients determine their fate at the end, and the results of that sort of social experiment in that state are, at least to me, sort of unknown yet. A larger scale experiment, I believe, will be taking place in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. That country just recently very much liberalized its euthanasia laws. And again, from a societal standpoint, it'll be a few years before we know whether that turned out to be a good or a bad thing.
Yeah. I suppose it's impossible to say, really. I guess every doctor would have to speak for himself or herself. What would happen, for example, if you got involved in a case where there was no advanced directive and the individual was not in a position to say what they wished to be done, then what do you do?
In most instances, the physician will rely on family members who said, well, he or she told me this before they got into this condition, that this is how they would like to be taken care of. If there's a question or concern about the appropriateness of that in the hospital setting, physicians have access to an ethics committee, and you can request a formal consultation, much in the same way that you request a consultation for a medical problem, from the ethics committee, who will come in and try and gather as much information as they can, and as a group discuss the sort of relative pros and cons of various treatment approaches.
About 10 minutes left with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. If you have a question, you can call us. We have two people ready to go here. Others are welcome. We'll take as many as we can. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Oh, thank you very much. I'd like to ask a question that somebody just asked me yesterday, and now that you're on, could you comment on the term aphasia? They're talking about suddenly someone has some kind of speech problem. Is that what it's related to, and what can be done for it? Or is that a neurological area?
This is primarily a neurological symptom.
Yeah, I thought so.
Where people either have difficulty understanding
uh-huh.
language, which is a receptive aphasia, They hear you, but they don't understand it, yet they can still speak, though what they say may not make a whole lot of sense because they didn't understand what you said.
Yeah.
And then there's also an expressive aphasia, where they may indeed be able to hear and understand exactly what you say, but the words that come out of their mouth...
So this one would be best tested with a neurological specialist.
Correct.
Uh-huh.
The most common cause for this is the is seen in stroke victims.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, very good. Let's go back here to Urbana for someone else. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Follow-up on a question that was asked earlier. I'd like the doctor to elaborate on fatigue that follows major surgery. People who have prostate cancer surgery, people who have abdominal surgery, sometimes report that their fatigue goes on for weeks or months. Now, is there a different source of that? I don't believe you touched on that in your response to the earlier caller's question.
Hang
up and listen.
Okay. This would still sort of fall into the category of injury. A muscle that has fatigued due to exertion produces certain chemical byproducts that cause the body to be sort of sore and tired. When you think about surgery, it is a major form of trauma to the body. You're under general anesthesia when you experience it. Consequently, it doesn't register necessarily at that moment as a painful sensation, but it's the equivalent of getting hit by a car. You're going to be stiff and sore, kind of weak and fatigued as a result of that experience. And there is a significant degree of injury and shock to your body's system with major surgery, and there is a significant period of recovery that has to occur in order to get over that. That's been one of the advantages of some of the newer surgical techniques. When you think of the old open gallbladder surgery, that was a foot-long incision in the upper abdomen, and it took about 6 weeks to recover from that because it split a whole lot of tissue that then had to heal back up. The newer approach, using laparoscopic instruments, puts a couple of tiny incisions in the abdomen. All the work's done on the inside. There's a whole lot less physical trauma to the abdomen with the laparoscopic approach. Consequently, the healing time from that is much shorter. The other part of the equation here is the individual's response to anesthesia as well. This varies from person to person, but it's not uncommon for people who have had general anesthesia to feel weak or fatigued afterwards, even if they had relatively minor surgical procedures. And that's probably simply the chemical effect of the anesthesia on their brain.
Okay. Other questions again, welcome. If you want to call us, talk with Dr. Swearingen, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, one thing we said we thought we might talk a little bit about if we had some opportunity was allergies. We're in that time.
Tis the season.
Tis the season. And it seems to me that it's bad this time around. And I do remember when we got into April, hearing about some of the pollen counts being very high, unusually mm-hmm. high. And it seems to me that at least people I know are complaining about symptoms that I don't remember having complained about symptoms before. I think I'm having a little something of that in that line going on myself.
The classic seasonal allergy symptoms are the runny nose and the sneezing, the sort of itchy or watery eyes. In many instances, a sense of sinus or head congestion that goes along with the excess production of mucus that's stimulated by the allergic response. In some susceptible individuals, allergies will trigger their asthma. So it's not uncommon for us to see a flare-up of our asthmatic patients if their allergies get out of control. Fortunately, we have a variety of options for treatment, assuming that you can't just simply leave the area long enough to avoid it. Avoidance is always the mainstay of any allergy treatment. But the antihistamines are quite useful in blocking the allergic response. The over-the-counter antihistamines are quite effective, though they tend to be a little bit more sedating than the prescription medication. That's the primary advantage of prescription antihistamines, is that they tend to be non-sedating, but they're otherwise not any better at being an antihistamine than the over-the-counter ones. The recent addition of nasal steroid sprays have been very, very helpful in stabilizing the mucus lining, mucus membrane lining of the nose and sinuses, and again helps prevent the allergic response. And those medications have been quite useful. They're non-systemic, so you don't have to worry about systemic side effects from the medication. There are some good over-the-counter nasal medications, in particular, I hate to mention brand names, but nasal Crom is often very, very useful for individuals, and something like clotrimetan tends to be a good antihistamine and is probably one of the least sedating of the over-the-counter medications. So that's often a good combination if somebody wants to try something on their own before seeking additional medical advice. The prescription medications, again, have the advantage of being non-sedating, and then the nasal steroids are indeed prescription medications. For individuals who basically fail that combination of therapy, you may be looking at allergy testing, the purpose of which is primarily to formulate an allergy serum for allergy shots. And that's a long-term approach to treatment. That's something that would literally take years to be helpful. They have recently come out with some allergy medications that are primarily for eye symptoms, and there are a couple of different types of eye drops that are available. So depending on what your specific symptoms are, you can either target that one particular area or you can use some combination of therapy. Yeah.
I guess one of the questions that I do have is about the testing and what, just how useful that information can be for you to know what it is specifically, particularly if it's if it turns out to be something that's out in nature,
right,
that you really can't avoid. If it's right. If it's dust mites, if it's cats, if it's peanuts. You know, you can pretty much try to stay away from that kind of stuff. But
and
if it's tree pollen.
And most individuals already know it's the cat.
Yeah.
You know, and testing in that particular setting really isn't all that useful because 9 times out of 10, they've already figured out, you know, every time I go to mom's house and spend, you know, overnight with the cat, my allergies flare. Well, you've answered the question, what are you allergic to? Mm-hmm. And the treatment there is, you know, avoid the cat. For people who simply can't avoid it, the allergy testing then again is to determine what should go into the allergy serum that you're going to get shots with.
Hmm. So this old thing where we used to do all this skin testing, we would inoculate the person on their back or their arm, mm-hmm, or something. We'd put to this little pricks of this stuff and then to see what happens.
That is still done.
You're still doing that.
But the primary purpose for that is not necessarily to figure out what you're allergic to. It's mm-hmm. It's to you're at a point where you've said, I've tried all the other allergy stuff. Nothing's working for me. I'm miserable, and I'm willing to go ahead with allergy shots.
Mm-hmm. Also, I guess I found myself wondering as I've started to, I think, have symptoms more and more as time goes along. Is it, I went more than 40 years and I would have said, hey, no problem. And
I'm immune,
suddenly,
right?
I'm immune. And suddenly, within the last 4 or 5 years, is that something that you do, in fact, see that people could go a long time and say, hey, no big deal. And then suddenly they start thinking, hey, wait a minute. I think something's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe in my particular case, it seems every year it'd get a little bit worse.
That's not uncommon. And in fact, allergies can begin at any age. Yeah, I remember talking to one of my allergy professors in training. He said the oldest patient he saw with the new onset of allergies was 76.
So it can start anytime.
It can indeed start anytime. And repeated exposure builds that response. So it's not uncommon for somebody to say, well, you know, it wasn't too bad last year, but this year really seems worse. And next year may indeed be worse yet if you continue to get that same exposure.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess at about this point, we'll finish up. We don't have any more calls. And unless there's anything you'd like to leave with folks, eat your fruit and vegetables.
Eat your fruit and
drink
vegetables.
Drink plenty of water.
Drink plenty of water. Enjoy this lovely weather as long as it doesn't bother your allergies.
Doesn't bother your allergies. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's family practice physician at Carle Clinic. He's with us every other month here on the show on a Monday for this program we call Talk to the Family Doctor.